Today's episode is brought to you by Musical Theater Radio's merch store. Looking for that perfect gift for someone or just want to treat yourself to some great musical theater themed merch? Head to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the All Things Theater button on the homepage and check out all the different designs available. And now, today's interview. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I'm your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. In October of 2023, I was in New York for the NAMMT New Musicals Conference. On Friday night, I wanted to see a show, and a musical about Star Wars was playing off-Broadway, and I knew I had to go see it because Billy Reese, who we've had on this program a few times, wrote the music and lyrics. So I get there. The gentleman in the box office greets me. Fantastic. I buy my ticket. All good. Then Billy shows up. I say hello to him, of course, because I know him. And the box office person says, "Hell, you know Billy." And I explain that I play his shows on the station, et cetera, et cetera. I just go into everything. And after the show, I talk more with Michael, who sold me the ticket. And I get to know him and what he does. And not only was he doing box office, he had to clean up and close up the theater, but he was also the co-director of this piece, as well as the co-producer of the show. Now, my point is, there might just be more to the person who sells you a ticket to a musical than you realize. Now, that was a long intro, I know, but I think the wait will be worth it as I welcome Michael Dangora to the show. Michael, hello.
Hello. I'm literally waving, like physically waving, like you can see me right now. But I'm very happy to be here. High energy, waving, hello.
Awesome, awesome. Yeah, it was... Before we even get into all this stuff, yeah, you got, in theater, you got to be able to do everything. And you're the epitome of that. You know, what I saw
really
that.
You really do. There's tons of people who've been very successful in one lane, but, so often it's such a collaborative art form that we often have to wear many, many hats. And a lot of times, especially, doing projects that are not on Broadway, we often have to, learn new skill sets and solve problems that would normally be part of someone else's department. Or, you're always wearing a million different hats when you're working in smaller theaters and kind of having to be a jack of all trades.
Yep, it makes sense. And I tell everybody that all the students I work with, you got to do that. You got to be able to do everything and know everything.
You do. And I didn't even realize how valuable that was until I realized that not everyone knows how to program a light board or basic stuff that has to happen in a theater. But I grew up doing community theater in Lincoln, Nebraska, and the Lincoln Community Playhouse was great with their children's theater department of not only, if you weren't in the show, the kids also got to stage manage and run the light boards and move the sets and make the props. And so I didn't even realize I was getting an invaluable theater education just by being a part of my community theater growing up.
It's so true. It's so true.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into to all that other stuff, I always ask for a 30-second bio. Now, we've already learned a little bit about you, but who is Michael in 30 seconds?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I was born in the wagon of a traveling show. I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and literally I saw my first, well, I guess people mostly want to lead with the exciting stuff. I'm a producer. Right now, I'm a co-producer on Harmony on Broadway, the Barry Manilow, Bruce Sussman musical. I'm a co-producer on How to Dance in Ohio, which is history-making with its representation on stage. I'm going to be a co-producer coming up in a few weeks now on Suffs, about the women's suffragette music, which it's transfer movement, which is transferring from the public. And then in the past year off Broadway, I was the producer of Walking with Bubbles, which won the Off Broadway Alliance Award for Best Solo Show. And we had a musical about Star Wars. I've been running this little theater where we were running in rep, a musical about Star Wars and Naked Boys Singing, which I've been a part of for God, since 2009, I think. We had our show Newsical running for a while, which is kind of like Saturday Night Live. So that's just been kind of the my past year of work. But I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, and saw when I was like 4 or 5 years old, saw in our shopping mall like a little skit presentation in the middle of the shopping mall advertising a big sale in the mall, and they were doing The Wizard of Oz. And it was my first time seeing live performers, as far as I remember. And like when they were marching down the Yellow Brick Road, they were all marching in place. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. I get it. I'm using my imagination. I get it. They're supposed to be walking someplace. And then like the Cowardly Lion came from behind the audience. And I was like, oh, the element of surprise. Oh my gosh. And I can't explain it, but 5-year-old me, just like a light bulb went off. And I told my dad, I was like, we got to do this. And he helped me put on The Wizard of Oz in my backyard with my cousins and whatnot. We made the sets and costumes, and you know, we were 5 years old, and the pictures of it are adorable, but I literally have not stopped doing theater since then. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And since then I've, you know, done mostly known for producing, but I really enjoy directing, and I do a lot of our own marketing, and I do enjoy doing the graphics and video editing and all that fun stuff as well.
Nice.
That was a lot longer than 30 seconds.
That's
sorry.
Okay. You know what? You kind of rolled into my next question, which is usually, were you always into musicals? Well, obviously you were. So
yes, very much so. Very much so. But so we would do, you know, plays in my backyard and in my basement. But then I really got into haunted houses, and I don't care what time of year it was, like I was always building a haunted house in my basement. And then as I grew up, I became obsessed. Well, I was already obsessed. I was an 80s baby with Jem and the Holograms. And then I became obsessed with Madonna, of course. You know, every gay boy, you know, is kind of assigned one diva to worship their entire life, and they have to defend them till the end of time and be obsessed with them. And mine just happens to be Madonna. But I really got into like pop music, and really thought that possibly like pop music and MTV and music videos were going to be more of what I was going to. I mean, when you're, you know, 8, 9, 10, you really don't know what you're going to do with your life, of course. But being in Nebraska around that age, I was obsessed with that stuff. And, but I also started getting involved in our community theater. And that was such a, you know, a great place for me just socially. That's where all my best friends came from, and they're still my best friends to this day. But, that is really what opened the door to me learning to enjoy the process of putting on shows and the magic of working together and all that stuff. And since then, I have just been kind of a one-track mind of, oh, I'm put on this planet to tell stories and do theater and put on shows and make people laugh. And so hopefully I can continue to do that until the end.
So you directed The Wizard of Oz when you were 5, you said. Now, my question is, at 5, did you get the rights for it? Or should we cut this from the interview so Goncourt doesn't come after you? Or
I love it. The publicity will be great. let them come after me. But what was so funny, I remember so vividly, I was not a good director at the age of 5, shockingly. I remember being so upset when we had to march down the Yellow Brick Road, and all my cousins just went tearing off into the backyard and just skipping around willy-nilly. And I'm just standing there in place being like, no, this is how they did it. We're all supposed to be standing here. I was a total diva, probably threw a temper tantrum because these people did not understand, you know, the blocking, which I never had explained to them, I'm sure. Yes. So I'm probably not the best director at the age of 5, and not a good producer. I didn't get the rights. So, you know, there's a learning curve to all of this, I suppose.
Well, there you go. You started at the bottom, and you got better. And that's more important than anything, right?
Well, and that is such a, I remind myself like so much. There's so many projects, especially like as a producer and stuff, you kind of are, you have to be the catalyst. You have to take the first step. You're not, very rarely are you jumping onto someone else's, you know, project. So you're the one who has to register stuff and take all the first steps. And the first steps are the hardest and the most terrifying. And, you know, the first draft of everything is normally the worst draft. And so it's honestly the scariest part of it all. Wasn't even a question, but the scariest part of it all is that first step. And then just, you know, getting better and better and better with each step you take.
Hey, you know what? You got rid of it. You got that over with. You got past that before puberty. So that's awesome. Get it over with.
Yes. Definitely. I was a hard worker and a hustler even then.
So obviously you love theater, you love musicals, and you went to New York for school. How was that as a transition from Nebraska to the Big Apple?
No, well, I always assumed I would. There was no other path for me. You know what I mean? I was like, I do theater. That's what I do. And I'll have to go to New York to do it. And because I also never wanted to be a big fish in a small pond. And I love my hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska, and would happily, you know, go back and work there. And you know, but I always wanted to, I grew up worshiping Madonna and rock stars. And I was like, no, I want to be out that level. I want, you know, I want to be working with them. And what's very funny is then even growing up, meeting people, meeting actors that I admired and whatnot, I was never like I wouldn't fan over them. Like I wanted to know about the industry and I wanted to work with them. Like I'm like, you could call me one of Madonna's biggest fans, but honestly, I'd much rather work with her than just go to a concert, you know? I always wanted to be a part of it, a part of the larger picture of it all. So yeah, so I knew I had to move to New York, and my family was very supportive. I was very, very lucky. And I did a NYU summer program between my junior and senior year of high school, and spent like 5 weeks in New York City, and you know, learning from everyone at NYU and getting to see a million shows. And I actually, last night I was in the audience of Harmony. And do you know Adam Guan, the composer?
Yeah. I've interviewed Adam. Yeah.
He was my RA that summer. Oh. And he was sitting behind me last night at Harmony. I was like, oh my God, I haven't seen you. I'm like, God, I don't even know, you know, that NYU program was over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And he was the sweetest then, and he's the sweetest now, and just such a great guy. And it was great to reconnect with him last night.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then I went back to Nebraska for my senior year and ended up going to Marymount here in New York City. And even though like I grew up performing mostly, I always knew listening to the, you know, the cast albums and stuff, I'm like, oh, I'm not as good as them. And I didn't realize that no one is as good as them, you know, when you're a kid and you have to work hard and, you know, learn the techniques and stuff. So I was very intimidated by that. But I always knew like, oh, I think I'm more the behind the scenes stuff. The even performing though, growing up, I was always much more concerned with, you know, like, what does the marketing look like for our show? And I was always more concerned, like, for our talent shows, like helping my friends rehearse their numbers. And, you know, I'd be like, oh, I'll be fine. Mine will be great. I'll nail it. It'll be fine. I don't need to rehearse. And so I was just always more involved with, or more concerned with, the larger picture. So when I moved to New York, Marymount had a directing major. And then while I was there, they randomly also built in a arts administration minor, which I had already just naturally, I was drawn to a lot of these courses that were already a part of that minor. And so when they started offering that, I was like, oh, I literally have to take like three more classes to get this minor as well. And that that was very invaluable as well, because I thought I was going to be mostly directing, but I've ended up doing a lot more producing and a lot more of the business stuff. And all those classes were very, very helpful.
Wow. So how long ago was that, if I may ask?
Yeah. I moved to New York. I graduated high school in 2000 and moved here that September of 2000. And at the start of my second semester, so like January 2001, I needed a job. My parents were like, well, support you first semester, but you have to, by second semester, you have to find a job. And I walked up to the TKTS booth in the center of Times Square, and there were, you know, kids handing out flyers and stuff. And I was like, oh, hey, hi, I think I'd be really good at this job. I don't know. And sure enough, was hired right then and there. And I ended up running a promotions company at TKTS for 20 years. And it's where I met my husband. It was a very weirdly defining part of of who I am in my New York existence. So many people know me as like the TKTS guy. But it was very interesting working there because it was a training that you cannot get anywhere else and you can't explain to anyone else. Well, I mean, I kind of try and explain it, but you're literally sitting there all day long just talking about the current shows on and off Broadway and learning what general audience members are responding to and liking. And, you know, with the flyers and the graphics, you know, you hand them a flyer and they're like, oh, that doesn't look so good. And you start to learn, like, why doesn't that flyer resonate with people, but that flyer does resonate with people? Or why does this show, if I talk about it this way, people seem really interested in it. But if I describe it this way, they're not as interested in it. And you're constantly just getting immediate feedback from general audiences. And it was a bizarre, I wouldn't, you know, it was a job, but it was a bizarre training as well that really taught me a lot about audience behaviors and just how the industry works on the whole.
So what was the first show you produced in New York? And what was that like? Yep. Because now you're in the Big Apple, Broadway, everything's there.
Well, yeah. So I met my husband, who was not my husband at the time, obviously, at TKTS as well. And we hated each other, but that's a whole other story. But, and we still do not get along at all. But, you know, I guess for whatever reason, fate brought us together and we're supposed to be together and we love each other, you know, unconditionally. Yeah. We just don't get along. Anyways, so he started working there. Long story short, all of my friends went away for a semester, like studied abroad, all of my close friends. And I was like, I have to stay in New York because, you know, who knows, Broadway could call it any second. I don't know why I just, you know, when you're a kid, time is totally different. And, yeah, you know, 3 to 6 months seems like an eternity. Anyway, so I was stuck here in New York with no friends. And I was like, well, that Tom guy, he's Tom Dangora, my husband. I was like, well, he's at least easy to chat with. So, and being that we worked at TKTS, he got free tickets to a show one night. And we went and saw it together. And we literally have not been separated since. So he was a frustrated performer, a character actor who just didn't quite know where he fit in and didn't, you know, especially when you're a young kid and a character actor, you know, everyone just wants you to be a perfect chorus boy. And it was a different day. There weren't the, you know, the Avenue Q's and the Book of Mormons and whatnot. And so he was just kind of frustrated. And I was like, well, why don't we do a cabaret to showcase what you actually do, as opposed to you going to auditions, trying to fit into other people's molds. And so we created a show for him called Divas I've Done. And it was all about his obsessions with Liza Minnelli and Ellen Green and the Broadway divas. But we really studied the genre of cabaret. We went to all the people performing in New York. We went to a million cabarets to learn, again, what we liked and what we didn't like, what we thought worked and what didn't work. And so when we showed up at Don't Tell Mama to do our show for two performances, we showed up with a full script and light cues and sound effects. And they were like, huh, what? We just thought we were going to get a song running order. And they were shocked that we were treating this like a full Broadway extravaganza. And then that was supposed to be for two performances. And someone wrote a review. A random person was there, wrote a review. And was like, this show needs to keep happening. It's one of the best cabarets I've ever seen. And so we kept doing it. And then someone wanted to bring it to LA. And then Tom even Playbill did a Joe's Pub concert of like the leading man. It was called the Leading Man Concert. And it was like Cheyenne Jackson and Matthew Morrison and Raul Esparza and all these people who were also very young at the time. And my husband. But then we started doing an off-Broadway run of it. And, on the off nights of a show called Newsical, which we were not producing at the time, but we knew the producer of the show Newsical. And on Sunday nights, they had the space open. And we were like, can we do the show on that stage? And he's like, sure. And I was like, hey, we can sell tickets at TKTS. And I can certainly go out there and pass out flyers and market it. And And we started learning about, you know, doing a show with a real off-Broadway contracts with equity contracts and everything. And it was, so we started producing that, mostly as a showcase for him. And then we just kept doing it because it was going really well. And then, and around the same time, then we started making some money with, we had our own TKTS promotions business, where like shows hire us to go out there and talk up their, you know, their shows. And we, what was I gonna say? What was I gonna say? I don't really remember. But around that, so we had our own company and we started making like decent money. And everyone was like, well, now, you know, you have to invest, do smart investments. And so one morning, I actually went home for Christmas and Tom called me on Christmas morning and was like, I know what we need to invest in. I was like, what? What? He was like, Ellen Green needs a CD. And I was like, I think people mean like investing in stocks and real estate. But yes, Ellen Green does need a CD. So we got a hold of Ellen Green and we produced her CD. And then we also with TKTS stuff knew that Christmas was a time, this is obviously way pre-pandemic. Christmas time, every single show pretty much sold out nonstop for the entire month of December. And there weren't all the, with the exception of Radio City and the Nutcracker, there was really nothing else on a mainstream level that was Christmas oriented. And so we were like, why don't we do an off-Broadway, like we called it a Broadway Diva Christmas. We got Ellen Green and some of our other Broadway diva friends, Maya Days, who was just in, had just started in Aida, Marla Schaffel, who was just nominated for the Tony for Jane Eyre. And we put on this very elegant, sophisticated kind of adult alternative to Radio City. And it was very elegant and people were very, very complimentary of it. And it really was, we were just flying by the seat of our pants. We knew nothing. We were in over our heads. Thankfully, everyone involved, everyone's first choices, everyone's instincts were correct. And it really was a stunning, stunning show that I still am so, so proud of. And so those were our first, that was our first commercial off-Broadway show. And that's how it all started, I guess.
It's crazy because I hear these stories so often that people just do it. You don't know. They're like, I didn't know what I was doing. I just did it. And it's so
Exactly.
true. You don't know what you don't know. And sometimes that's better because there's the rules. You're not supposed to break these rules. No, you don't know them. Just do it and get it up. So.
No, exactly. We knew nothing, but we just had to learn. So it's like, how do we don't know how to do a budget. Well, let's put a budget together. Luckily for my classes at Marymount Manhattan, I knew how to write a press release. And it was also the beginning of really the start of, it was the early 2000s. So like the internet and the chat boards, we didn't have social media or anything. But you know, I'd create fake names and go on the chat boards and try and drum up excitement. And so we were also, you know, that was a totally new frontier, kind of the wild, wild west. And you just had to make it up as you go along and try different tactics. And yeah, we had no idea what we were doing, but we learned along the way and had a, you know, a very stressful, I look at it with, you know, rose-colored glasses, but oh, it was stressful and miserable and nothing ever went well. And, you know, you wished for, you know, death every 2 minutes, it felt like. And every night was terrible. And, you know, I really developed a really strong, you know, drinking habit from it. And, you know, I'm just like, yeah, it really was miserable. You're in the trenches. But for some reason, when all is said and done, you look back on it with such weird fondness for some reason. And it was a beautiful product. And we made lifelong memories.
That's fantastic. Congratulations on the beginning and getting that up and doing it. So obviously you kept doing it and you're still doing it. What did you go from there? Yeah, obviously you
From
had a
there, we did.
successful thing.
We did. Actually, several. My husband had also been in. Randomly, had been in Naked Boy Singing in Provincetown, which for people who don't know, is like a gay beach town at the tip of Cape Cod. Tennessee Williams wrote a lot of his plays there. John John Williams lives there. Wait, what is, why can't I think of his name? Hairspray.
Oh,
why can't I think of his name?
Mark
John
Shannon?
Waters.
Oh,
John Waters.
John Waters. Oh, okay, yes, the movie.
Yeah, well, I was like, what the hell? But it's a really fun, very gay artist community at the very tip of Cape Cod. And he had done Naked Boy Singing there, and it was a mega hit. I actually was, that summer, I was in Lincoln, Nebraska for the summer, and saw on CNN that this production of Naked Boy Singing in Provincetown was being shut down every day because the nudity laws, these antiquated nudity laws in the town. And they were getting sued every day, but they were making so much money at the box office that they could pay their legal fees every day. And anyways, so Tom was a part of that, and was like, that was such a hit. He reached out to the person who had produced it, and he's like, hey, I'm starting to produce a little bit. Would it be cool? Would you and Michael, or would you be okay if me and Michael maybe tried our hand at doing it in Provincetown with you? Next summer. He was like, sure, I'll show you the ropes of it. And we eventually started doing Naked Boy Singing in Provincetown. And we did a lot of like little club acts and stuff, which was also an education unto itself. And through that, you know, we put up our own production of it. And over time, the New York producers, we were doing that every summer. And it was very successful. And over time, the New York producers were, you know, just maintaining any long running show is work. It takes a lot of time and hours. And they were like, hey, the show's still making a ton of money. We just don't have the bandwidth or the want to continue, you know, spending all of our time on this. Would you guys want to take it over? So in 2012, essentially, they closed the original Off-Broadway production. And a few weeks later, we put up a quote unquote revival of it, which was our production. And so that's how we became a part of the history of one of the longest running off-Broadway shows of all time. And then this show, Newsical, which I had explained earlier, was being produced by someone else. That one was kind of like a Saturday Night Live show where they'd make fun of Oprah and you know, the politicians and whatnot. And at the time, you know, Martha Stewart going to jail. And we were working for Forbidden Broadway at TKTS for many years, and I knew how to sell, you know, parody. And I also knew that, hey, if I can sell a random tourist who has no idea who Patti LuPone is, you know, a musical that parodies Patti LuPone, I can certainly sell them on a musical that parodies Oprah Winfrey, who they know. And that's kind of, so we reached out to the producers of that, and we're like, hey, can we, you know, I know you had a short little run, can we maybe give it a shot? And then sure enough, we put it up, and that ran for over a decade off Broadway. So that's kind of how that all started. And we were always since we had always kind of been our own, we were always the lead producers. It was always us calling the shots and doing everything. We kind of were always, we got obviously invited to be co-producers on Broadway shows a lot, but we were, you know, so, oh my God, we're both so egotistical and self-centered. And we're like, no, when we go to Broadway for the first time, we want it to be, you know, our project, and we want to, you know, call the shots and blah, blah, blah. And that just wasn't happening for various reasons. I can tell you crazy, crazy stories of, you know, all the close calls that fell through and, you know, all the lawsuits that should be that, you know, that we have every right to sue people over, and we're just not going to be those people. But yeah, there was, you know, obviously rocky, rocky roads, and so, in this industry, so many projects get so close to happening and then just fall apart. And eventually we're like, okay, we need to make this leap into Broadway. And so we kind of were like, well, let's just, I was actually working at TKTS, and one of the shows that we really, really were like, what would be a great show that we would want to bring to Broadway after all these other projects had fallen through? And we're like, Caroline or Change was my husband and my favorite musical. We loved it so much. We saw it so many times. When he did his Divas I've Done show in LA in his contract, we had it so that we would be there at the same time as Caroline or Change when it was playing at the Omison, and that we'd have a few nights off where we could go see it. Starring a young Ben Platt, actually, fun fact. He was like 9 years old at the time. But so what was funny is we reached out to them, the Carolina Change people, and they're like, oh my God, we'd love a revival. However, there's this little production in London that some people are working on trying to bring to New York. If that falls through, of course, we'll reach back out to you. Cut to, I'm at TKTS and a producer is in line, a British producer who I just kind of casually know from working there and whatnot. And I'm like, oh, what are you up to? And he's like, oh, I'm one of the projects I'm working on is bringing Carolina Change over. And I was like, oh, you're part of that team? Wait. Called my husband immediately. And we were like, yeah, let's see if we can take a meeting with them. So we ended up taking a meeting with them and getting on board with the Carolina Change revival a few years ago as our, you know, it was a very conscious choice that we wanted that to be our first Broadway endeavor, something that we loved passionately and believed in passionately. And we weren't just doing it for, well, I mean, it was the worst business deal in history, but that's another story. Mm-hmm. But we just wanted, like, at least our first to be memorable and special and something that a memory that we would cherish forever and feel proud of for always, you know. And then the pandemic hit and then all sorts of craziness. But Carolina Change was our first foray into Broadway from there.
And that's a great segue because I wanted to jump ahead to the pandemic because you guys did so much stuff then. Tell me a little bit about, you know, how being in New York and what was your experience? Because I've talked to lots of people who were in shows that were opening that night and they closed or they had stuff that was about to go on. So I'd love to hear your experience and what you did during the pandemic, which was really cool and interesting.
Oh, well, and again, it was none of it was premeditated. At all. First of all, I was working at TKTS and literally when Broadway shut down, we thought everyone who worked there was like, well, we are all dying because we are the ones sitting here dealing with tourists from all over the world nonstop. I was like, I can't even tell you the amount of people I, you know, spoke, you know, close to, you know, face to face with over the last week. But come to find out, we were all working outside and germs don't seem to like to travel that well outside. Anyways, so the first part of the pandemic was kind of funny because everyone who worked at TKTS, we were just waiting for 2 weeks to find out who got it first. And then no one did. It was so crazy. Like, we stayed here and, you know, all the, I think it was Frozen was maybe the first show to be like, oh, we're not coming back. And we had a dear friend who was starring in Frozen. And I was like, oh, that sucks. You played your last show without even realizing it. One day we live in Hell's Kitchen. We live in the theater district essentially. And we eat a lot at West Bank Cafe, which is right across the street from our apartment. And we had our wedding rehearsal dinner there. And we've had a ton of opening night parties there. And the owner, Steve Olson, is like the nicest guy and makes everyone there feel like family. And it's just a great restaurant. And the Laurie Beachman Theater underneath it. And we found out from a neighbor that on New Year's, they were going to close their doors for the last day. They just did not have the finances to soldier on. Mm-hmm. And this was about 2 weeks before Christmas. And my husband and I heard this from our neighbor and we were getting ready to walk our dogs. So we took our dogs into the restaurant and we're like, Steve, what's going on? And he's like, yeah, we're at the end of our rope here. And we're like, okay, what would help? Like, what can we do to help? What do you need? And he's like, honestly, all I need is money and that will solve these problems. And so we were like, what do we really think is doable? And he was like, honestly, like $250,000 would just solve everything for the time being. And we're like, okay, that's not a crazy amount of number. Okay, let's think about this. And at the same time, an actor, Tim Guinea, who eats there all the time, was picking up a to-go order and was overhearing this. And he's like, oh my gosh, no, you guys have to stay open. And if there's anything I can do to help, please let me know. I'm very connected. I do a lot of TV and film. I know a lot of people. Let me know how we can save this place. And we exchanged numbers and we went and walked our dogs. And by the time I got halfway around the block, so about 90 seconds later, I literally just turned to Tom of like, we should, because this is literally how I always think. I'm like, we should put on an old fashioned Christmas telethon. Because I think, you know, whenever there's a problem, something with show business will solve it for some reason.
Yeah.
I grew up with Jem and the Holograms, where every week it was some problem and this rock band had to, every problem was solved by putting on a concert, to the point where my mother, anytime I threw a temper tantrum or anything as a child, my mom would always be like, I know, let's put on a concert. to mock me, because that's how I thought we solved all of our problems. But in this case, it really was how we were going to solve our problem. And I said, hey, no one is going to be doing anything on Christmas. No one's going to be with their families. No one's going to be at parties. Everyone's going to be very isolated. Plus all these Broadway performers are just sitting at home doing nothing. I was like, what if we had a whole day-long Broadway telethon where people could pledge money and watch Broadway performers, you know, sing Christmas carols from their home, and it'd be something festive and holiday-ish and feel, you know, special and unique. And we called Tim Guinea right there, like, so we have an idea. And he's like, oh, well, I actually was just talking to my agent, who said if you need any people, they can get us Alan Cumming and Julianna Moore and just, you know, Deborah Messing and Nathan Lane and just all these people. And we're like, okay, well, we have an idea for a star-studded telethon, but we have to do it on Christmas, which is in like 12 days for it to be effective. It has to be on Christmas because that's the headline. Yeah. And so he's like, what a great idea. So we literally just got to work. I had never streamed anything in my life, again, knew nothing about it. So had to learn. I was using my video editing skills, and we were calling everyone we had ever met, every Broadway performer. I'd be like, hey, would you just sit in front of your computer and sing, you know, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas? Can you do, you know, some fun poppy Rocking Around the Christmas Tree type stuff? And everyone said yes. Everyone did. And I thought, you know, first I was like, oh, I can't do a full day telethon. That's going to be impossible to do up to 12 hours of programming. Let's settle for 4. That'll feel epic and monumental. Christmas morning, 4 hours. Well, as we got closer and closer to Christmas, everyone just kept saying yes and contributing stuff. And we'd go over to West Bank and film a few people safely. So we'd have some shots in the restaurant, like Andre DeShields performed a number in the restaurant, and Alice Ripley did a number in the restaurant, and Joe Iconis, who came on as a producer as well, opened up his Rolodex so we could call all of his friends, and he wrote an opening number, and the New York Times covered it, and it was just a huge success. It was a, you know, it was very much a It's a Wonderful Life moment for Steve Olsen and the West Bank Cafe. And so, of course, literally as that was happening, Birdland called and was like, hey, we're in a similar situation. Can you help us? And we're like, okay, you're literally like calling us right now during like what would be essentially the final tech rehearsal. So give us like 24 hours and we'll get back to you. And so then that was a huge success. And so we called Birdland and we're like, okay, if we're going to do this, we have to do it in another way that's going to get attention. We don't have Christmas Day as our headline. So we worked really hard to, and we also didn't have 10 days to pull it off. We gave ourselves a month, and we decided to put on something that would be comparable stylistically to like the VMAs or a very performance heavy award show in style. And my husband worked on both Hillary campaigns and was able to get Bill Clinton to open it for us. And Clive Davis spoke, and all these jazz legends, Wynton Marsalis, performed, and that again became a huge success, and we raised, you know, close to $500,000 for them in one night. And so then it just kept snowballing from there, and we did stuff with the York Theater and the Labyrinth Theater and the Theater World Awards, and it was we just kept doing all these benefits, and we never took a penny for it. We volunteered all of our time, and cause we didn't feel right, you know, if we're asking all these people for money to help, you know, these venues and asking all these performers to donate their talent. Mm-hmm. We're like, well, we can't take a penny for it, you know? So we donated all of our time, and during the pandemic, cause we had nothing else going on, we put on several very big and very cool shows that ended up being Emmy nominated. And again, it was one of those things. We had no idea what we were doing when we started. And by the end, we had raised, you know, over $1 million for some beloved venues in our neighborhood, and made some really cool connections, got nominated for Emmys, and we had no idea what we were doing.
It's as terrible as the pandemic was, you know, to the world and our business, everything. It was almost a little bit of a blessing that we had that downtime in to discover, you know, how to do all this stuff online, learn audio, learn video, get to know each mm-hmm. other, to build these things we would never have done in a million years ever.
And now I make a few extra bucks periodically running the live streams from Birdland whenever Like Julie Benko has a show coming up beginning of February, which you should all tune into because she's fabulous and amazing and starring in Harmony as well on Broadway. I do all the live streaming stuff for Birdland, which was, I guess I'm the expert on it now, which is funny because it was a skill set I, 2 years prior knew nothing about and had no desire to learn.
Yeah, it forced us to learn, and now we have these skills forever. And online, you're able to do that now and stream it, and that's kind of where we need to go as a business. Live theater is live forever, but opportunity and accessibility and things like that.
Accessibility is something that definitely 100% needs to be reexamined, and it's so much easier with shows that are non-equity. Like the Stranger Things parody that was off Broadway and was a riot and had a killer cast and was super fun. They did a very successful live stream of their final performance that was very successful artistically and I know financially for the producers of it. But because it was non-equity, they were able to do that. And that's something that with Broadway and off-Broadway shows and the Actors Union equity, it's, I can get into actors equity, but it's a lot more difficult and challenging, and it's unfortunate because it's such a great tool. And as someone who grew up, in a pre-YouTube age, I was on, using the internet to find illegal bootlegs of illegal recordings of shows. And I had so many of them. I still have them in a shoebox, old VHSs and cassette tapes and stuff, but it never deterred me from buying a ticket to go seeing the show. If anything, it made me want to go more. I would get tapes of these understudies in Rent that I was obsessed with Rent. And so when I'd go to New York, I'd want to see them, and I'd go see Rent for the 9 millionth time because I'd want to see such and such understudy who I love from the bootleg so much. And it never once deterred me from actually buying a ticket and supporting the show itself. And I think a lot of producers have always been scared that it would do that.
Yeah.
But look at Hamilton on Disney. Certainly did not hurt that show's trajectory or financial stability at all. So I hope that's something that we see a lot more moving forward, and I hope we find more fun, creative ways to get musical theater out into the general public. It's not pop music that you hear on the radio. There, it's a harder medium to get out there because it is such a immediate thing that can only be captured. The magic of it can only be captured in one room with one group of people. And so finding ways to, put that magic out into the world is going to be, I think, something very big for our industry in the next 10 years.
Agreed. The audiences want it. The producers can see the money, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's the union that's going to be. Unions take forever, no matter who or where, no matter what business it is. And they got to realize that this is only going to benefit their actors, their members. But
absolutely. I mean, there's a reason everyone knows, the name, everyone knows the name Ariana Grande because she has several pop albums that are on the radio and stuff. However, no one knew the name Ariana Grande when she was in 13 on Broadway, but had 13 done a live stream or something, perhaps she would have gotten an audience sooner, it's a really interesting tool that, I think everyone's realizing we need to utilize a lot better.
For sure. So tell us a little bit about some of the projects you just worked on, because I know you introduced me to Walking with Bubbles. How'd you get involved with that one? That's a fantastic concept. I interviewed the creators. They're wonderful people. So tell us a bit about that and some of the stuff you got going on right now.
Well, everyone always says, first of all, for the listeners who don't know, Walking with Bubbles is Jessica Hendy's one woman musical that's also her completely true story. She was a Broadway performer. She was in Cats and Aida and Amour. And during this time, her husband, who was a aspiring writer, and they had a beautiful relationship, started to show signs of depression, and his depression kept worsening and worsening. And eventually they moved to, they thought it was seasonal, so they moved to a tropical island to try and help him. And she really put her career on the back burner to try and help him. And it just, his problems kept worsening. And it basically turned into the musical follows her helping, watching her husband just fall into this incredible mental illness, and eventually became homeless and could not be helped. And it's her story of coming to terms with that and dealing with that while raising their child and pursuing a Broadway career. And so this woman, Jessica Hendy, had done one of the benefits we had done for one of the Hillary campaigns a long time ago, because she was a big Hillary supporter. And she was fabulous. A friend had suggested her. We heard her sing at an event like a few weeks prior to that. We're like, oh my God, who's this chick? She's amazing. And we've been around long enough to know, like, wait, there's Broadway performers who you just know who is supposed to be working nonstop in this industry. Like, and she was one of them, and it didn't make sense. And then she invited us to this reading of a musical that she had done as a friend, wanted us to come see it. And she was very persistent, and we're like, okay, we'll come, you know. Just to warn you, our dance cards are very full right now. We don't have room or time or bandwidth to take on any projects, but we'll come see it. And all I knew was about her being a mother, a single mother. And I was like, I'm sure this will be very charming. And 5 minutes in, the bombshell drops that her husband is homeless. And we're like, what is this story? What? And literally everyone in that room of that first reading, just everyone sat forward. And it was incredible. It was brilliant. It was so moving. And she was like, can I just pick your brain? I know you guys can't, you don't have the time or resources right now, but she's like, I just don't know what even the next step for me to take is now. And we had dinner, we all got drunk. And by the end of the dinner, we were like, you know, this show is too special. We believe in this show too. We witnessed something truly magical. It needs to happen. So let's just make it happen. And so that's kind of how that's how that happened. And from, I think, reading to first off-Broadway performance was like something like 6 months or something insanely short. But it was an incredible experience. We got great reviews. Audiences loved it. It won the Off-Broadway Alliance Award for Best Solo Show. She was nominated for a Drama Desk Award for her performance. And now it was a limited run, and we're kind of looking at next steps for the show, hopefully in a much larger capacity. We'd love to see it on Broadway, the West End. So many people have suggested it as a movie for some reason, which is very exciting, because it really is a very unique story that you just have never been told before. And it makes you look at a social issue, you know, homelessness and mental health, in a very different and personal light. So it was a very, very meaningful project to be a part of. And what's so funny is that with that, it was our first time doing an off-Broadway show that really was, for lack of a better word, like, I don't even know basically for 10 years we had been doing musical and naked boy singing and a musical about Star Wars and basically just telling like fart jokes on a stage for 10 years. So it was such a difference for us to be doing something so impactful. But what's funny, now we're doing, you know, Harmony, Carolina Change, Suffs, How to Dance in Ohio. All these shows we're very excited about the shows that we're working on and aligned with right now. For their social content, and especially in a time where, you know, the business of Broadway isn't necessarily great right now. It is a very bizarre landscape that we're kind of all trying to figure out right now. But at the end of the day, I can be incredibly proud of the works we're doing for their social value, what they're bringing to the community as a whole with you know, How to Dance in Ohio. And also the stories that we're telling that are, you know, like Harmony, are stories of the past, but are incredibly relevant wake up calls to today. So it's been kind of funny that for 10 years we made, you know, a life telling poop jokes and putting naked people on stage. And now we're doing all this, you know, important stuff, quote unquote, important stuff.
Now, as a side note to listeners, if you want to learn more about Walking with Bubbles, we had our interview with Jessica. And you can check that out and learn more of it from that side.
And the cast album just came out too. We just put out the cast album a few weeks ago as well. So go stream that. And if you like it, consider buying a copy of it through the show's website, because that's, you know, you make like half a penny if you stream a song. But if you buy the album, that actually supports the artist much more.
I did buy it. It is in
Aw,
rotation.
Thank you.
So yeah, I'm playing it.
Thank you. Thank you.
No problem. So what have you, you've got so much stuff going on right now. What is there anything that you want to promote or talk about, or anything you have in the pipeline that you can talk about?
Well, the project I'm most excited about right now, I can't really talk about because
of course.
I'm writing it with these guys right now, but it's kind of out there and weird, and it's a type of story that's never been told on Broadway before, and I'm really excited to be diving into that. But yeah, I'm actually, what I'm most excited about with what we have going on right now is actually Harmony on Broadway right now, which is not doing great in the box office, and yet everyone who sees it falls in love with it, and it's like, oh my God, this show needs to run forever. It feels like in the last few weeks we're starting to get a little momentum, but I just urge people. I talked to a lady who was like, I heard it's sad. I'm like, you cried at the end of Schitt's Creek. What are you talking about? Like, it's okay to cry once in a while. You know, it's an incredibly moving story, but an incredibly cathartic experience. And it really feels like a classy, elegant, timeless, old school night on Broadway. The set is gorgeous. These adorable boys in tuxedos singing these huge, you know, choral arrangements. It's really a stunning, stunning show that everyone who sees it is loving. And so many people are like, oh, I'll get tickets when I come in April. And we're like, no, buy tickets now. Buy tickets today for April, because that's how shows stay open. We're in a society right now, no one's buying tickets ahead of time. And it's hurting every new show terribly, because you count on pre-sale, and that's just not really happening. So if you have any interest in seeing Harmony, please buy tickets now. And if you have no interest in Harmony, do yourself a favor and just go buy a ticket, because you will love it. If you're listening to musical theater radio, you will love Harmony. You are the audience. You will not be disappointed. Chip Zion's performance is a must-see. I hope he deserves the Tony. Julie Banco is just a masterclass and such an amazing rising star. And all six of those boys are incredible. Sierra Boggess is, and she's great. It's just Warren Carlyle's direction's great. And of course, Barry Manilow and Bruce Sussman wrote it. I saw it again last night and was so moved. And I'm so proud to be a part of it. And it will easily go down as one of our best producing accomplishments, I think. At least for us personally, anyways. I'll let the audience decide for themselves. But for us, it'll go down as one of the best.
That's fantastic. Congratulations on all that and the shows and everything. How can people learn more about you and what you do? Social media, websites, etc.
Yeah, my husband's very good at social media. He's Tom Dangora. And then I'm on there. But my website, michaeldangora.com, DANGORA.com, is slightly outdated. I should probably update it at some point, but I'm just very busy. But that's the best way to learn about what we're working on and our projects. And if people want to get involved with producing, people are very intimidated or think that, you know, they need to be a millionaire to do it. And it's not that at all. So if you have any interest in getting being a part of these shows, it's pretty easy. Reach out and we'll help you learn the ins and outs of being part of a Broadway producing team. It's very exciting and very cool.
Maybe I'll do a round table. We'll grab a bunch of producers and we'll just talk and you guys can spout your words of wisdom to
well, you'll be, as you can tell there, everyone's as long-winded as I am in this industry. So we'll be here for weeks.
It'll be an eight-parter.
Exactly.
Awesome. So I'm just going to ask one last question before you go. When is the Gem and the Holograms, the musical, happening?
I think about this quite often. I mean, it really, you know, they made that movie a few years ago with Molly Ringwald.
Yes.
Apparently wasn't good. I'm like, no, you need to do Gem and the Holograms the way it's supposed to be done. It needs to be 80s-tastic. It needs to be so campy and glitter, you know, pop rock and all that stuff. So who knows? I don't think I don't think it's a big enough pop culture name to be a large scale musical, but I think it could certainly support a very campy movie musical adaptation, maybe. So maybe I'll get to work on that sometime in the near future.
Play Jem. Who would you cast as Jem?
Oh dear Lord. I mean, she runs an orphanage by day and is a secret rock star by night. I mean, she's the original Hannah Montana. I just don't know,
Yeah.
I just don't know. But we'll have to have a you know, maybe we'll find a new star. We'll have a star is born moment.
Okay. I'm more of a Misfits guy, but that's a whole different
Hey, fair enough. I have a Misfits t-shirt, oddly
thing.
enough. So
Nice.
yes, I do. I do, and I wear it. And every now and again when I wear it, people are like, wait, is that what I think it is? I'm like, yep, it sure is, my friend.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on today
Of course,
and
of
talking to
course.
you and getting to know you. And I know I'm gonna have you on again to talk
Well,
more
you know where to
stuff
find me.
because yeah, exactly. Thank you. Congratulations. And yeah, we'll definitely talk again.
Fabulous. Excellent. It was great chatting with you.
Awesome. We were just speaking with Michael Dangora, producer in New York and director and everything else, as we talked about, he can do anything in theater if you just ask him, or he'll figure it out. Tune in next week as we'll speak with another guest or guests about their life, love, and passion. That is musical theater. I am Jean-Paul Jovanoff, your host as always. And until next time, I'll see you when I see you.